Hey, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glad you could join me. Great podcast in store for you from the Cabela's podcast studio. Fascinating guest with some great conversation, some ideas that you probably ought to at least consider, and then a bunch of advice. This guy's done it all, from hunting Himalayan snowcock to, let him tell you about all of that. In the meanwhile, though, you'll also get all the usual stuff that you enjoy here at the Upland Nation, from a public access tip, some hunting dog strategies and tips, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and, of course, sympathy and all the other things that come from owning hunting dogs. In fact, you have, by listening alone, have been following Flick's progress. He's now 3 years old and getting closer and closer to what some people consider a finished dog. To me, he might be the first and maybe the only dog I ever have that actually is steady to wing shot and fall, and that's what we're working on right now. I'll be talking a little bit more about that in the Handle It segment down the road here at the Upland Nation podcast. We are continuing our search, though, for water to train for the duck search. Living out here on the desert, it's at a premium, and especially access. Most of the water is, I'll just describe it as privately controlled. The public water is crappy, pardon the pun, among other things. In fact, just went out to the relatively new sewage treatment plant where the treated water is dumped into a bunch of ponds that are allegedly clean, but unfortunately it is evaporating faster than they're filling them up again, so that one's out. So if you're living in Central Oregon and you got a great pond with NAVDA utility test water on it, I'd love to have some of that just once in a while, and so would Flick, especially when the temperature hits 90 degrees like it is today. Having some great training otherwise, though, I'll tell you, and I'm going to just tell you one more time what a great thing it is to bring a few guys together once in a while to train as a group. Yeah, it's a little bit like herding cats, but when it comes together well, and thank you, Ben, for being a part of that. Sure has been fun doing that and seeing the progress of both your dog and my dog and all the other guys and their dogs when they come along as well. All right, so here we are. We're just about ready to talk to our guest. His name is Brian Koch. He's with the website Ultimate Upland, among other things. Right after a couple brief messages from our sponsors who give us the time and the resources to bring you this podcast, including Sage and Breaker, gun care products crafted at the highest caliber. One of my new articles for the site is now up. I like to think it's slightly funny. It's full of shooting excuses. Feel free to steal as many as you like from that. It's all at sageandbreaker.com. And the best news, their new gun cleaning mats are back in stock for both long guns and handguns. Take a look at all of that stuff while you're at sageandbreaker.com. And then I alluded to Flick's training and his steadiness. Well, I can thank the Dogtra T&B dual collar system for most of that. One controller, two sets of buttons, one collar on the front end and one collar on the flank of my dog, and all of a sudden he can be steady, he can retrieve, and all those things become easier to stage manage because I don't have to mess around and toggle back and forth or find the right spot on a touch screen. It's all right there. So welcome to the Upland Nation podcast, Brian Koch. Where are you calling me from these days?
You know, I'm out in Ohio right now. A number of years back, I moved back to Ohio to be closer to my family. And so we're in Northeast Ohio, not really the center of upland game birds, but it's the center of where I grew up.
Can't be all bad. I was born in Rocky River, Ohio, so we're going to get along just great.
Rocky River is only about 15 minutes from me.
Oh, there we go. Well, I got smart and left when I was 2. My parents followed me to Los Angeles, but that's a story for another podcast, or for never, actually. So how have you been, and what are you doing these days?
You know, I'm not too bad, Scott. Since SHOT Show, when I saw you last, things kind of came apart in this country. We all left SHOT Show, and apparently we were hit with a pandemic. So probably a lot like you, I've been kind of just sitting tight and trying to be responsible in some ways. I still get outside with the dog some, but really just been kind of in a holding pattern until probably about 2 weeks ago. And our cases have been kind of steady in Ohio, but as more and more data comes out and it shows that your chances of catching any kind of virus in the great outdoors is fairly minimal, we've started shooting again and actually just started to train for the season again. So we're getting back at it.
Great. And what kind of dog you running these days, Brian?
Well, I've got that young lab of mine. She's coming up on 3 here. So she's my project. And then my kind of steadfast old companion, I've got that Llewellyn Setter who's coming up on 10. And she's got the game down pretty well. And then I've got a really old lab. He's going to be 13 on July 4th, and he may have had his last hunting trip this last season. We'll see how things work out with it, but that's my crew for now.
Yeah, it's a big feed bill.
Yeah.
But I love it, and I hope your old guy gets out for at least a couple minutes on each of your hunts this time around. Of course, a lot of your hunts are quite physically taxing, if I recall. I think you might be the only guy I know who's actually gone hunting for Himalayan snowcock. What prompted that?
You know, that was back before. I think there's been a bigger push now in recent years for more hunters going after Himalayan snowcock. But back when I did it for the first time, I actually had just met a guy from the Rubies area, you know, the Ruby Mountain area online. We struck up a conversation and I decided it seemed like something that I would like to try. And 1 year when I was out there at SHOT Show in Vegas, I rented a car and I drove over to the Rubies after the show, just scouting. Mm-hmm. And I was impressed with that area. And I was like, well, this will be a challenge. And that's how I kind of got started in there. And really, so with snowcock hunting, it's just most people don't take their dogs. Yeah. That area is particularly treacherous for dogs if they're not used to that. And so now my hunting for snowcock, I haven't been for a number of years back, besides the fact that it's just extremely physically demanding, but you've got to have it timed up right so that you've got a dog that's experienced enough that's not going to be dangerous for them. And a dog that's not too old. So really, there's small windows in time, because I don't do anything without the dogs. I won't go to the Ruby Mountains without the dogs. I don't care if it limits my chances for actually shooting a snowcock or not. I'm not going to do it if I can't do it with dogs.
Amen to that. And in fact, that's why I turned down that trip. I was at a safari club convention where I actually talked with a mountain lion guide whose side gig to his side gig was guiding the craziest people in the world, the guys who are willing to ride one of his mules to 10,000 feet, get off and walk to 12,000 feet, and then stand there and pass shoot those snowcocks if they swing by on their way down the hill. Tell me in a nutshell, what is that experience really like?
It's worse than you probably have actually seen, because I don't think it could be captured very well in video. Even some of my video that I did, and that was a number of years back, it just doesn't capture it. It's worse and better, I'll say. As you know, the highest points you can drive to in the Rubies is about 8,900 feet above sea level, and snowcock country doesn't really start until about 10,500. So just to get in the game, you've got a 2,000 vertical foot incline to get up, just to get in the ballpark. And when I did it the year I did it, and I've done it, I've been out there twice and spent some extended time out there. And really, I spent a number of, my second trip out there, I did a number of acclimation days out there where I was hiking, trying to get lungs geared up. But really, the climb is fairly brutal. And then when you get to Snowcock area, what you learn is that these birds are crazy wary. They're just that it's like they're constantly being hunted, and they are, because there's golden eagles on those peaks that are picking those birds off, and so they always are watching. It's almost like they've always got a sentinel up in their groups, and they make some of the craziest sounds. They're beautiful birds. The closest I ever got to one was 90 yards, and that was after two trips. So it's a rough hunt. It's what it's cracked up to be. It's a really rough hunt with dogs, just because there's lots of dangerous areas for the dogs. And it's just tough physically. It's demanding. I'll go back, it's still on the plans. I think to actually, take on with a dog would be something. And I know people have before. They're locals I talked to before my second trip, who were using Weimaraners, and they sent me pictures of their Weimaraners pointing birds. So it can be done. It's just really difficult.
Kind of the tilting at windmills for upland bird hunters, I think, but that's not all you do. But I'm going to describe you to a small degree as an extreme bird hunter, because if you go to the ultimateupland.com website, usually you're above tree line. What's that all about?
Yeah, Scott, I don't know how this ended up happening, and I write about it some, because it's not where I started out with upland hunting. It's not like I was I'm from Ohio. We don't have chukar, and we don't have ptarmigan, and we don't have these high elevation birds. But it seems like the last few years, that's kind of what I focused on. 2 years ago, it was just a preparation year, where I wanted to learn more about what it was going to take in terms of physical demands for me to start chasing birds at really extreme elevations. But elevation really hasn't been, I guess, the main goal. When I think about my seasons and how I've been hunting, and as we talked at SHOT Show, that last year, basically I spent the entire month of September doing nothing but hunting 14,000 foot peaks in Colorado. So that was all part of a plan. And I guess people ask me about, what's the goal, besides, trying to kill myself, I think. I want to do things differently. I don't like the way that, in many ways, that upland's portrayed in a broad media sense, where there's a devaluing of birds in my mind. That it makes it look easy, that you see people standing with piles of pen raised birds. And I think that type of coverage, in my mind, devalues the pursuit as a whole. And so really what I've been doing these last few years, especially, is I'm trying to reframe the conversation, which is, this pursuit doesn't have to be easy. It actually isn't easy in many ways. And so that's how I end up on those mountains, is just trying to reframe the conversation more about the experience. I'm never really concerned. And, we talked about this a lot at length out at SHOT Show. I'm never really concerned about shooting birds, because I don't find that that's the entire experience. I want to focus on, from the second I step away from the truck and what I feel like and how difficult it can be and how awesome the birds are. And the truth is I root for the birds most of the time. I don't root for myself.
Amen to that. And absolutely hold those thoughts, because we're going to talk about that in the second half of the podcast. You and I have a lot of fodder in that world that we're going to parse out piece by piece as we go. Everybody out there, if you're wondering, I'm Scott Linden. That's Brian Koch. He's the founder of ultimateupland.com. I'm the host of the Upland Nation podcast. Brian, Tell me a little bit about the website, why you did that, and how it goes and what your goals are for it.
Yeah, well, you know, UltimateUpland.com started back in 2010, and really it started a little bit before that as an idea more than anything. But the website itself started in 2010, and initially I never had any intent to write articles about upland hunting or do any videos or really, you know, be at the forefront. Really how it came about was there was a downturn in the economy and businesses were hurting everywhere. And I needed to find something for myself that, that was also a good use of time, but also I thought would be valuable for other bird hunters. And so initially the website was just an aggregator for information where you could get all your information for out-of-state hunts, because I found it frustrating that when I was trying to go to these state Division of Wildlife websites, the information was totally inconsistent, hard to find. Back in those days, the internet was really slow. and so it could just take hours to try and plan out-of-state hunts. And so I thought, you know, there's a space there for this type of site. And that's how Ultimate Upland got started, really, is just an aggregator for state information. And we still have that information on the site. But after attending a number of SHOT shows and being in the industry, if you will, for a while, it started to become clear that what sponsors want and what advertisers want is they want a personality, as you are well aware. So being in the background became more and more difficult. And then with the advent of social media and kind of how social media took things over, people want a face with their stories or their information. And so that's how people kind of consume upland hunting information now. And so that's kind of where it led to, call it 10 years later. And who knows how it goes. It's tough to say, Scott, how it goes in this environment's a really tough environment to be in, because as you know, marketing dollars dry up as companies have problems. It's like the first budget that goes, right? So
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah, we will, won't we? Well, I'm knocking wood, because I'm staying busy with a number of projects. And hey, by the way, everybody, our next season of Wing Shooting USA is looking really good. I can't wait to share it with you. But in the meantime, talking to Brian Koch at UltimateUpland.com, UltimateUpland.com. Brian, I'm going to guess I think I know what it is, but ultimately in your book, what is it about bird hunting that gets you so excited?
Yeah. And for your listeners who don't know or aren't familiar with my background, you know, I grew up hunting all kinds of things, from deer to varmints. I was really a varmint guy in the Midwest. That's kind of where I got my start. And now I've swung to the far extreme where I can't sit still anymore hunting. And I only want to do it with the dogs, but the dogs are really the driving force, for me. I like, that experience, that cooperative hunting. I like being able to see that there's this genetic, code in them that drives their actions and how they work in this cooperative effort with hunters and people in general. And so it's really the only thing for me anymore. I can't sit still. Hiking without a shotgun, I'll do that occasionally, but I always find it a little bit more entertaining when I have a shotgun in hand and there's a potential for birds. So that's really what's been, you know, what I like about the sport, the pursuit. And you know, it's not just about the dogs. I think there's an appreciation for the outdoors just allows me to commune with nature in kind of a different way too. Something I need to stay sane. You know?
Yeah. And by the way, there is no 12-step program yet for you and me and all the rest of us who are caught up in that same addiction. And I think I'm grateful there is no such thing, because that's what it's all about for most of us. You've had a number of dogs over the years. Some of them are high altitude dogs. Anyone in particular that you think works best in, you know, that above the tree line kind of work?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the dogs, my Llewellyn setter right now is good in those mountain scenarios, but I have to trust her. And as an example, and she scared the living daylights out of me multiple times. And in some ways, you know, I've learned to trust them. I've gone from having them on leash in really dangerous scenarios to being off leash and just trusting that they're going to be able to handle it themselves. The labs generally, when we're in those types of areas, they rein themselves in automatically. They're just used to it. They bring their range in a lot closer to me. Now the setter, she'll still let it rip no matter where we are. She'll range pretty far out there. But when I was snowcock hunting with her 1 year, just as an example, what you end up doing, because you're hiking for basically a couple hours after you leave the truck before you ever get to snowcock country. But there's a moment when you can see the top of a mountain where there's this sense of relief, right? It strikes you. It's an adrenaline rush. You know that you're almost there. And my setter's name is Rio. And so I saw Rio. She had just gotten out to what looked like the top of the mountain and the Ruby Mountains, this peak we were climbing. And really you're trying to get a vantage point for where you're going to potentially see birds. So when you get out there to the top, it gives you an opportunity to see both directions off of a peak. And I saw her at the distance, and she was stopped at what looked like the top of the mountain. And she was still probably 100 yards away from me, but I got this adrenaline kick from just knowing, oh, we're almost there. This climb out is almost done. And as I got within 25 yards of her, I could see that her front toenails were on a precipice, and it was actually inverted with a 1,000-foot drop. It was basically an overhang of 1,000 feet straight off of her nose, where her fingernails, her front paws, were just over the edge. And so I literally crept up to her, because she was looking very intently off that precipice. And I just crept up to her and I said, in a very quiet voice, "Rio, we're not going that way." And I tried, you know, and I had to call her back to me just to get her off of that face. But but they get used to those areas. They could scare me a lot worse. Obviously, if she'd have taken another step, it probably wouldn't have been a good scenario for any of us. But I'd like to think she was smart enough not to.
That's a chucker hunter's worst nightmare. I live it every time I'm out there, but not going to keep me or my dog out of those hills. And I'm glad to hear your story had a happy ending. You know, because you're doing some of this, a lot more than most of us, and because I'm really fixated on this right now, if you were to give us any advice on how to get in better shape to do that kind of stuff, or even, you know, the more civilized version of that, if we're going to climb a couple hills for Hungarian partridge, or out here in the West, we're chasing chuckers, not quite at 12,000 feet, but, you know, we're getting up to 6,000 and 7,000 feet. What would be the one bit of fitness advice you would give us?
Well, leading up to the season, what I do, and I'm on the extreme level, but what I, you know, that last month before I start, I'm working out 7 days a week. And I'm doing various cardio, anything from what's really good if you've got a gym membership, stair stepper. Leading up to the hunting last year, you know, I could do an hour of stair stepper carrying weight in either hand, alternating hands. So, you know, that's pretty extreme. But what I will say is that, you know, this year we're probably, our plans are going to be a bit lower and not as extreme in the elevation, but I'll still get to that point where I'm at least doing cardio for 30 minutes a day. And I do that 7 days a week leading up. And that's really only because, Scott, it's because of the durations of my trips.
Right.
I have to train because of the wear and tear over time. If it were just a fitness thing, then it would be, I could probably go a little bit less, that's what my, you know, so my recommendation for the average guy who's only going to go out there for maybe a week, but going to be, you know, going to be fairly extreme, you need to, 2 months out from your trip, you need to start you know, doing cardio, whether, and that doesn't mean you necessarily have to run. It means you have to, you know, if you're not in a person that can run, you can bike. You got to elevate your heart rate to above, you know, 140, 150. When I was out there in Colorado last year, hiking with, you know, my vest and water on, my heart rate was getting up to 180, 190. So, you know, you've got to get your body just prepared for that. So, you know, 3 or 4 days a week of cardio would be a good lead up to a season for most guys.
Yep. Yep. How about for your dog? Do you do anything in particular to get your dog in as good a shape as you?
Yeah. You know, a lot of guys believe that there's the training for dogs should never end, right? That basically training is a year round thing for dogs. When they're not hunting, they should be training. But because of some of the areas we've been to, and I don't, you know, the dogs now are have the experience level where I don't have to train them to learn new things. But as far as the physical capacity goes, younger dogs, like my young lab, yeah, we'll leading up, and we've just started now, but I only do a couple days a week where some people will call it roading, but it's not roading because I do it on my bike so that I'm getting my cardio while the dog's getting their cardio.
Yeah.
I've got basically an attachment. I attach the dog to the bike, and we'll go out in the morning before it gets hot, and I'll run each dog for 3 to 5 miles on the bike. So that gives me 10 miles on the bike. And then I may do an additional by myself. So that's generally what I'll do with the dogs. And then leading up, you know, to bigger trips, we'll start extending that out. So the later in the summer goes, I'll do just longer distances. But what I found is I don't want the dogs to break down. Again, I'm not just taking the dogs out for a week. You know, we're out for a month or 45 days at a time where they're going to have to go every day. And so my experience in the field and hunting with them that way is that they have that it adds up just like it does on people. Like if you do 5 miles every day, day after day after day, that there's a cumulative effect. So I try not to put a whole lot of wear and tear in the off season of the dogs. I want them in shape, but I also don't want to add to the continued beating.
I get it completely. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. That's Brian Koch. He's the founder and the principal actor behind ultimateupland.com, Facebook page the same, Twitter, I think, and also Instagram the same. Am I right there, Brian?
That's right. Ultimate Upland all the time.
Great. And I'm Scott Linden, and this is the Upland Nation podcast. Brian, now you get to relax for a couple moments while I do all the heavy lifting here. So let's remind everybody that we still got a lot more to talk about, including in the second half of this podcast, some of Brian and my pet peeves, I'll call them. We'll stay politic at this moment, at least for that. Hold on for the dog training tip that I always offer. It's called Handle It, and it'll be here in just a moment or two. Brian, relax. I'll bring it back on in just a moment. And in that moment, I'm going to remind you that Dr. Tim's Performance dog food is my dog food of choice. Well, Flick's dog food of choice. Let's put it that way. Man, that guy looks good right now. He is in such good shape. And I got to thank Dr. Tim Hunt, veterinarian, sled dog racer, for the formulations that we use. And we go back and forth. There's a couple there. One's called Momentum and one's called Glacier. There's a slightly different protein ratio in each of those, but they all have these high levels of omega-3 fatty acids, and that helps strengthen the immune system of the dog. It reduces inflammation in skin and joints, like Brian and I were just talking about. When you're roading your dogs, you want to be careful about that stuff. And there's also a heart health aspect to all of those omega-3 fatty acids. Tim Hunt has figured out how to put all that into a dog food that looks good, tastes good, it's easy to travel with, and those are the things that are important to me, and more importantly, to Flick. Remember, there's a 30% discount on your first order. Just use the code UPLANDNATION. Tell Dr. Tim I sent you. And if you're hearing me now, well, then you haven't screwed up your hearing yet. My friend Jack Homa at Electronic Shooters Protection knows the value of protecting your ears. Learn more about it at espamerica.com. Shooting the new course at the Redmond Rod and Gun Club last weekend with my good friend and training buddy, Ben. he was still using those foam plugs that, you know, everybody gives you for free, and there's a reason for that. I had no trouble at all with my ESP hearing protection devices. I'm trying to get him a pair, and I'm going to work really hard at that. He also shoots for a living in the U.S. Army, and thank you for that, Ben. He knows the value of hearing protection, and I think he deserves a little bit better than he's getting right now. So remember, hearing loss is cumulative, and it is permanent. Remember that. Go to ESPAmerica.com. All right, welcome to the Handle It segment of the Upland Nation podcast. It's where I get to give you all the excuses I use when Flick doesn't do what I want him to do. And hopefully you will learn the easy way, because I have learned the hard way. How about a little bit more under the recurring theme of the Cheapskate's Guide to Training Birds? Yes, as my friend George Hickox says, no birds, no bird dog. The problem is, where do you get them? Well, most of us can't get wild birds most of the time. And if you can, they're very expensive. And I mean, by wild, I mean game birds. Obviously, we can't train on wild birds all the time. I've mentioned the launcher in the past, and how if you watch your dog carefully and you're using a bird in a launcher, you can fly that bird before the dog crashes in. So I won't go over that again. But we've been working a lot with a bird on a tether. I use that tangle-free decoy cord. You can use whatever you want, but you do want it to be limp, but not too limp, because you don't want to get entangled on whatever shrubbery or grasses you have where you're training. What we're doing with it right now is we're laying that bird down. He's attached to the tether. The tether is attached to a weight. That bird is out in the open, because one of the things I'm training Flick for is to stop when he sees a bird. Not just when he scents a bird, when he sees it. Once he slams on the brakes, I go in, I can fly that bird, and it will fly 25 feet. He lands on the ground about the time I pop off the blank pistol. Flick thinks it's a dead bird, and he is staying steady. Woohoo! Thank you again, Dogtra, for the TNB duel on his flank. So you got a bird that goes up, gets, quote, shot, unquote, hits the ground. Great training scenario. And then the fun begins. All right. If you got questions about dog training or anything along those lines, I've probably learned it the hard way. Feel free to talk to me about it. Maybe it'll end up right here in the podcast studio, and maybe it'll help you. All right. Brian Koch, ultimateupland.com. Are you back with me?
I'm still here, man.
Okay. And luckily, that is only hay fever, and I can work my way through it. It's not the worst thing in the world. You all stay tuned. We've got the This Land Is Your Land feature coming up after Brian and I kind of chew the fat over some of the things that we have been, I guess, being politic, I'll call it, been bothered by over the years. You know, you mentioned something that I've developed a bit more of an obsession with than you have. And I ironically, you called it in your website the tailgate obsession. I'm going to just lay it out for everybody, but I'll let you start. Tell me a little bit about your feelings about what we see out there in social media, journalism such as it is, advertising and marketing communications. Give me your take on that and explain what you mean by it.
Yeah, well, the tailgate obsession, you know, I that came to me because of social media, which has become just a bigger and bigger piece of what we see in our lives, in the hunting community, but just in our lives in general. And I was always bothered, Scott, by the fact that we spend so much time in these beautiful places with amazing dogs, and the only documentation we see in social media, by and large, is a dead bird sitting on a tailgate at the end of a hunt. That was what people were seeing on social media, by and large, and still is. That, you know, 8 out of 10 guys out there who are bird hunters, the way they document their hunt is they lay their dead birds out on the tailgate at the end of the hunt, and that's what gets posted to social media. And I trust me when I say I don't have a problem with dead birds at all. And in general, I don't have a problem with pictures of dead birds, but the focus on dead birds in a social media setting was grinding on me. And the reason is because the bulk of people in this country do not hunt. I mean, the vast majority, 95% of people in this country do not hunt. And so instead of showing the elements of upland hunting, which would be more engaging to that 95% of people, the bulk of people are showing the one element that more people will find offense with.
Yeah, the polarizing. Yeah. It can be polarizing. Hey, believe me, I caught hell over this a while back, and it was very eye-opening, if you will, when I asked the question on a Facebook page, do we really need to show all those dead birds? And the argument, of course, is, hey, this is America, or this is my Facebook page, or whatever. Hey, they can go to hell, for that matter. It doesn't matter. But you're absolutely right in that regard. And here, yeah, I'm going to take it a step further, and here's what I see, and this is going to be an article somewhere someday. If what we really are trying to do, first off, we got to buy into the concept that we need to bring more hunters into the sport for a whole bunch of reasons. We'll get to that in a minute too. But if you agree that we need to recruit new hunters, and then you agree that the tailgate obsession and its various manifestations in advertising and in outdoors writing in general is single-minded, then these newcomers are only told one thing, and that is success is only measured in dead bodies. And if you remember back when you were starting out, and I remember when I was starting out, and everybody else will too, if you judged success based on the number of dead critters you put on your tailgate or showed in a big pile, you probably weren't going to stick around for the next day or the next season or anything else. I agree.
Immediately setting guys up for failure.
Precisely.
And I use guys in it. Obviously, we need women it as well. But if that is the bar by which we are judged and judging hunts by, and that extends beyond just bird hunting, obviously. But if the bar for success is killing animals, you are setting anybody up who starts in this for failure.
And my good friend Delmar Smith and his son and nephew, Rick and Ronnie, have all advocated for decades that you never give a dog a chance to fail. And here we are, forgetting all of that when it comes to living, thinking, rational human beings. All we're doing is creating the expectation of failure.
100%. 100%.
All right. So we got that off our chest. Anything else you want to talk about in that regard?
I could talk about it forever, Scott.
Yeah,
but
me too.
It's as you've seen, it's a hot button, and it's because there's a faction of hunters who believe that if it's legal, it's good.
Yeah.
No matter what that is.
And I'm not judging.
We aren't allowed to quantify. You know, we aren't allowed, as hunters, we aren't allowed to qualify what's better or worse. And as you know, when you start saying these things, and it's going to come up from the podcast, and you're going to get comments on it, and I'm going to get ripped online again, as I did when I posted that article initially, it shouldn't be something that's confrontational, trying to present this pursuit as something that's the most appealing to the broadest audience. But apparently it's still controversial for the hardcore hunters. We can beat our own chest and preach to the choir all we want. That's not going to help recruit more people into our pursuit.
And it only becomes problematic when the industry as a whole uses that criterion in their communications. And I challenge everybody who's listening right now, and then I promise to get off my soapbox, challenge anybody out there to open a magazine, watch a TV show, listen to somebody else's podcast, and not find an advertisement that talks about dead birds, killing power, all of the limits you're going to get, no matter what it is. It's all built around that expectation that that's how you define a successful hunting trip. Okay, end of discussion. That's Brian Koch. He's the founder of UltimateUpland.com. I'm Scott Linden, the founder of the Upland Nation podcast, among other things. Let's get on to our next topic, which has also been one of mine for a long time. And in fact, I've written on this both in national newspapers, local newspapers, and any number of other places. You hit the nail on the head with an article you wrote called "You Can't Spell Hypocrite Without REI." And I got to tell you, I've been there and done that. I was around for the last circus that surrounded an attempt to do this. But why don't you explain what you mean by that, Brian?
Well, when I wrote that article, there was a push by REI to eliminate all of the products in REI that were produced by Vista Outdoors, a outdoors conglomerate that owns lots of brands, but hunting brands and ammunition, of course, specifically. So REI took it upon themselves to basically call out Vista for their position because of the firearms more than anything. And they decided that they were then not going to sell anything that Vista Outdoor Group companies made.
And just for the record, which included things like skateboards, snowboarding helmets, hydration systems, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, headlamps, exactly. Camping equipment. You know, I mean, that's what it came down to. And so that sparks, lots of ideas for me and lots of, but really what it came down to is we need to have a broader conversation about how funding for the outdoors is happening right now, wild places and wildlife. And I think that, we're having that conversation currently, but as far as people with skin in the game, mountain bikers, campers, bird watchers, hikers, paddle boards, all those activities that people do in the outdoors, they aren't paying anything for the maintenance and management of wild places and wildlife. They're enjoying that resource, but they aren't paying for it like hunters are.
And fishermen. Just the background on that, we've talked about it here on the podcast once or twice already. Of course, there was an act back in the 30s called the Pittman-Robertson Act, and it created a funding mechanism that assesses an excise tax at the manufacturer level to guns and ammo, bows and arrows. And then there's a corresponding act on the fishing side that does the same thing. You never see that tax because the gun manufacturer assesses it and the distributor or the retailer ultimately pays it. But what that money does then is it goes back to the states based on the number of hunting licenses or fishing licenses that they have. And it pays for, well, in Oregon, for example, 80% of my wildlife department budget comes from that Pittman-Robertson money. As you said, mountain bikers, tents, bird watchers, none of those people are paying for it. I opened up an opinion piece once in a national newspaper with, if you love wildlife, buy a gun. All right. So anyway, your point being, Brian.
Well, my point being is that you can't say that you advocate for wild places and wildlife without having some kind of skin in the game, paying for it. And the exception that REI took with Vista Outdoors was out of bounds when a company like REI isn't contributing anything practically in sales. They do make a donation. It is under, I think it's 1/3 of 1% of their revenues. 1/3 of 1% is unacceptable. And quite frankly, any other outdoor manufacturers or brands out there who are only contributing 1/3 of 1% of your sales to sustaining wild places and wildlife, you should be put on notice, because that's brutally low. The standard, if you're not a hunter or in the angling world, or you know, is 2%. Just so you know. So yeah, you can look up what REI sales were last year if you'd like. But they're not contributing nearly enough money to sustaining wildlife and wild places, and nowhere in line with what Vista is contributing.
And just again, for the record, the excise tax on those guns at the wholesale level and ammo at the wholesale sale level is at least 10 and sometimes 11% of the wholesale price. So do the math. You're talking about, in a good year, $1 billion from hunters and target shooters. You can hold that up against any industry, any organization, from the Sierra Club on down, and they're just specks on the radar screen compared to that $1 billion that's going out from you and me and everybody else who buys guns and ammo, bows and arrows, and no mountain bikes. So the reaction you said was a little bit heated.
Yeah. I think within the first 2 days, there was enough traffic on that article, it crashed my site, and the server in general. And of course, you know, you can see the comments, which I engage with anybody who wanted to make comments. And obviously there were plenty of comments from people who don't understand how wild places and wildlife are being funded. And, you know, the main point of contention they wanted to make, well, you know, that's an excise tax versus what REI was donating, which is a donation. Well, what they failed to acknowledge was that sportsmen, anglers and hunters wanted that tax. We were the ones who lobbied to tax ourselves. So, that comparison or that point of contention is just it's a moot point.
Yeah, and then that's even before we talk about the dues we pay to all the organizations we belong to, and all of the fees, licenses, permits, and tags we buy, the duck stamps we buy, et cetera, et cetera. Now, just everybody should know that as we are talking today, the Land Water Conservation Act is being we're in the final lap on that, which at the national level should take a whole bunch of money from the oil and gas industry and throw it at public parks and wildlife areas and things like that. So the dynamic will change a little bit there, but the fact of the matter still is almost all the money that goes to wildlife management and conservation of wildlife is going to come through that 10 and 11% excise tax, no matter what else happens with that gigantic, what are they calling it now, the Great American Outdoors Act, which is an omnibus bill with a whole bunch of other things in it as well. But keep your eyes peeled for that. It'll be a good thing, because maybe it'll free up some of that other money so that you and I and Tom, Dick, and Harry with our hunting licenses and our guns and bows and arrows aren't funding conservation of the three-toed salamander and the ivory-headed woodpecker, just as, you know, on top of everything else. So anyway, so what else is getting you worked up these days, Brian Koch at ultimateupland.com?
You know, it depends on the day. I'm trying to keep it more level nowadays, Scott, and not get overly worked up about anything. Although I think, you know, what's on the radar, and I'm sure you've probably been seeing some of this, is the question that's still open in terms of this hunting season this fall is, are states going to allow non-residents to come hunt? You know, I don't know. Depends on who you listen to in the state. So, You know, what do you think about non-residents? Is that something that's going to happen this fall if we see a resurgence in this virus?
I am tired of speculating on anything having to do with the coronavirus because there's no logic behind the restrictions, the quarantines, the lockdowns, or any of the other decisions that politicized governors. And let's just make it clear, most of these things happen at the gubernatorial level. And there's no logic behind them. It's all about politics. So we will see. Now, the far-sighted ones will understand what side their bread is buttered on. And for example, South Dakota is looking at all sorts of things, including a massive marketing budget for attracting hunters. Also, I guess I'll call it sublimating the biology by not doing any brood counts this year. But they understand all this and they know what kind of dollars are at stake. So they may be on the forefront on that end, but you can imagine some of the other people's republics in the West Coast, for example, are maybe going to take a different approach there. And it's not going to be based on biology, science, or anything else. It's going to be based on making the president look bad right before the election.
Yeah, I think that there's chances even. So our state this spring, they shut down non-resident fishing licenses for a number of months, which cost a pretty penny to the coffers. But then we saw a resurgence in turkey tags. So and youth turkey tags actually made as I understand it, there was a record sale in youth turkey tags in the state of Ohio this spring. You can attribute that probably to the fact that everybody had more time since they weren't working, I guess. But I don't have the exact stats. But yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. It certainly makes it tough to plan a trip, though. I can tell you that.
Well, this is the fundamental problem because I try to be at the forefront of some of these things because, of course, I have sponsors in that world, whether it's South Dakota, the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks and Tourism, or even the city of Huron, South Dakota. So, yes, they're concerned. It's nail biting time. If you're out there and you're planning a trip, I encourage you to keep up the planning. I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised at the states where we would want to go anyway, welcoming us down the road. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Brian Koch. He's the founder of ultimateupland.com and accompanying social media. Brian, we're getting towards the end of this whole thing. I've got a few more things to say, but you don't have to listen to them if you don't want to. What do you want people to take away from all of this, whether it's this stuff we've just been talking about or this idea of striving for a summit of one sort or another in the bird hunting world?
The takeaways. I think that I've got mixed emotional takeaways, Scott. You know, there's for every minute I think about what it is that I'm trying to accomplish in this space, I have doubts about whether those accomplishments can work, attracting new people to the pursuit, or is that, you know, even a goal? I think that it's just for me, what it's become more about is moments, memorable moments. And if you're somebody who is searching for that type of thing in your life, making memorable moments, that upland hunting offers things that other pursuits do not. And the working with dogs and you know, the communing with other upland hunters to me seems more special in this space. And that's kind of what I go with. I don't have my goals are you know, all over the board, but my feeling is that I'm just going to continue to keep doing what makes me feel good, hoping that it attracts others to either what I'm doing or how I'm doing it. That's my hope.
And mine as well. And if you want to learn more about what he is doing in that world, ultimateupland.com is the place to start. You can search it Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or on the World Wide Web for what it's worth. Brian Koch, the founder It's a pleasure speaking with you. We got to get together more than every year in Las Vegas at the SHOT Show. Thanks for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me, Scott, and stay safe out there, buddy.
Wow. So I caught my breath. Brian has departed. Brian has left the building. Learn more about what he's talking about and get all the details at ultimateupland.com. Thanks for sticking with us. Lots more to talk about, including the This Land Is Your Land public access wild bird looking for freebies segment coming up right after a couple messages, including this one from Gunner Kennels. Learn more about them and their free shipping offer at gunner.com. It's my kennel of choice. If you're watching some of my videos, it's prominently featured there because that's where I put Flick when he's working with me, both on television and for fun. And I do a lot of hunting for fun. Go to the website, gunner.com. You can't make this stuff up. Dozens of real-life testimonials. Some of the photos are a bit graphic about car wrecks and that sort of thing. The dogs live to tell about it. In fact, if only they could. But the owners are doing a pretty good job of describing how well a gunner kennel protects their dog in a car accident or any number of other traumatic situations. All right, like I said, free shipping on every single gunner kennel out there. Learn about what else they're doing and the accessories and all the other reasons that it would be worth your while to take a look at one. After all, he is your hunting partner and your most important hunting partner. He never complains about your cooking, does he? And at dogtra.com, you can learn all about the T&B dual collar system and why it is so useful in Flick's development. And you can also get 10% off any purchase over $200 if you use the code SLUN10. Same thing, over $200. The shipping is free at dogtra.com, whether it's the T&B dual. They got a single version, save yourself about $100.50. Just get one of the collars. And then when your wife gives you permission to add another puppy, you can just order another collar with your weekly allowance from her, or however else you make money to pay for your filthy dog habit. I speak of what I know, and I know of what I speak in that world. Believe me, it's all at dogtra.com. Learn more right there. Yeah, Woody Guthrie said it first. This land is your land. This land is my land, and all that jazz. Well, all that folk. And this is the segment where I clue you into something that might help you find free public wild bird hunting. Now, most of the time it is public ground of one sort or another, but it could be walk-in ground, some sort of conservation group area, or whatever else. I got a long list of that kind of stuff at findbirdhuntingspots.com. If you'd like to learn more about all the choices there, sign up for my mailing list, and I'll send you a copy of my new short 4-page guide to all the publicly accessible land out there, including some of these hidden gems that I've discovered over the years that you may not have thought about or even knew how to learn more about. How about the Federal Bureau of Reclamation? I'm thinking of a particular spot on a particular river in South Dakota where the dam is administered by the Bureau of Reclamation, and so is the surrounding ground, which just happens to be populated by a pretty decent ringneck pheasant population. How about the Army Corps of Engineers? They're building all sorts of great stuff all around this country, and most of their projects are open to the public in one way or another. A lot of them have camping, a lot of them have fishing, and some of them have hunting. Military bases? Yes, they do. How about the Tennessee Valley Authority and other dam administrators beyond the Bureau of Reclamation? Out here in the West, it's the Bonneville Power Administration, for example. And even some of the privately owned areas. I fish the heck out of land that is owned or administered by Pacific Gas and Electric in California, for example. And many of those places are also open to hunting. just take a look, sign up at the website, and you'll get the whole list. And then whenever you're going somewhere, just take a quick look at it and explore a little bit more. Most of those places will be on your state's hunting atlas. Some of them won't, and most of them won't be on some of those online mobile apps. And that message is also brought to you by HuntHuronSD.com, my good friends in Huron, South Dakota. More pheasants than people, and 124,000 acres of public access, just like I've described. Can you hear me now? I know that was a cell phone commercial a while back, but it's still true for protecting your hearing. At ESPAmerica.com, you can learn why that is so important in the field as well as the range. ESPAmerica.com. And with that, I will thank you for your kind attention. Hope you enjoyed our talk. Brian Koch, UltimateUpland.com, thank you for being a part of it and raising a few hackles and a few good questions at the same time. Of course, if you're a listener and you want to discuss any of that, the best place to do it is the Wing Shooting USA Facebook page or the Upland Nation Facebook page. If you liked what you hear, then rate or review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or iHeartRadio, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And when you do that, your name goes into the hat for a drawing for a pointer over and under shotgun. So no matter where your state is in the lockdown release mode, don't forget to hug your family, say hello to your friends, and spend some quality time with your bird dogs. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Scott Linden. Enjoy the rest of your week.